This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, LA Clippers owner Donald Sterling has been condemned across the board for his racist remarks in a taped phone conversation, but a difficult question has come up in light of what's happened. What right does Sterling, or any of us for that matter, have to privacy?
First, it's time for Curious Wisconsin. For decades, if you drove down Highway 12 between Baraboo and Sauk City, you'd be greeted by a view of thousands of buildings. They were all part of the Badger Army Ammunition Plant, which was once the largest munitions facility in the world and played a crucial role in three American wars.
Since being decommissioned years ago, there's been significant change at the Badger site, and the majority of the plant's buildings are now gone. Last month, the Sauk Prairie Recreation Area officially opened where Badger once stood, and for the first time since the 1940s, the public has access to the land, which reaches well into the thousands of acres.
Today on Curious Wisconsin, we take a look at the history and future of the Badger Army Ammunition Plant site, and here to help us do just that is Verlin Miller, archivist with the Badger History Group. Verlin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Badger Ammunition Plant has a long history here in Wisconsin. We just heard a thumbnail sketch of some of it, but it's going on to a new life. What's the overall vision for what Badger's going to become?
I think that's a good question. Some of that is not answerable yet because the DNR is still working on their master plan process. I'm not sure when that will be done. I'm pleased that they're not working on a date deadline. They're working on it as it goes. When it's done, it's done. And I think that's the right way to do it.
And it will be a public site for recreation.
Yeah. It's just a question. We don't know yet what kind of recreation.
And everybody's offering up plans. I think a lot of people have suggestions of what they'd like to see that turn into.
I think you name the outdoor interest group and the DNR has heard from them, including Badger History Group.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the history of Badger. It was designed to be the largest ammunition plant in the world. You worked there for a good long while. Can you give us a sense of just how big this place was?
The original, in numbers, the original acquisition was 10,565 acres. That was in 1942. After World War II, they sold off some of it. And they got it down to 7,300 acres, actually a little less than that. Then they had to reacquire some of that land for the Korean War. So at that point, it was 7,300 acres, and that's what it was when they declared it excess in 1997.
And this land that it's on, this place is pretty much steeped in history, even before the Badger Ammunition Plant. Can you give us a little bit of the history of the land itself?
Well, it was farmland, 74 farms, 26 Wiggins Bay cottages, 3 churches, 3 schools, and 3 cemeteries were taken for the Badger Ordnance Works. So it's a story of people more as much as the land. I look at it that history is not a story of a place or buildings or machines. It's the history or the story of the people who were born, lived, and died and worked on that place, worked with those machines, and worked in those buildings.
And those people before the plant, there were farmers there who were moved, in effect, because of the building of that plant.
Yeah, they didn't have a choice. The government came in and told them, we are going to buy your property, end of story. Their initial offer was a lowball offer, which most of them did not accept. And so they went through the condemnation proceedings and got a little more. I think they got close to market value, but I can't really say for sure because I don't know what market value was at that time, except that it was pretty lousy because this was the end of the Depression. If it had been 3-4 years earlier, it would even have been worse.
Do we know where they went and if they're aware, if any of them are still around to see the change in the plant?
Some of the farmers, some of the families went to Columbus, Stoughton, Baraboo, Sauk Prairie area. Some of them quit farming, retired. I grew up across the street from a guy who'd had a farm there, and I didn't even know it until I got with Badger History Group looking at the acquisition map and the names there and thought, holy cow, I knew him. And there were some others that were members of my church. My dad was a self-employed carpenter, and I recognized some of those names as his customers.
Mm. So the U.S. is building this arsenal of democracy, a war against Germany and Japan. They need this largest ammunition plant in the world. Why did it end up here in Wisconsin? Why on that site?
They had a list of criteria. See if I can remember how much of it I can remember. 250 miles from the nearest coastline. That was security. A good supply of water. Close to our electric energy supply. Highway transportation, highway and rail. Away from a metropolitan area. You don't put an explosives plant in the middle of a big city. And I think there were some others there. A labor force. And I think the last one was politics. There's politics in everything.
What was it like for the people who worked there? I mean, this thing was huge and it employed a huge number of people. What was it like then?
During World War II, the employment was just a little over 12,000, construction and production. Korea and Vietnam, both the peak was about 5,400. It was a busy place, and it was a significant economic impact, positive, on the area when it was in operation. And I think even after it was... when it was in standby.
I mean, this would have been one of the bigger towns in Wisconsin during World War. I mean, 12,000, not one of the biggest cities, but this is a large population working there.
Oh, yeah. Across the highway from the powder plant. Well, the powder plant was 3 miles wide by 5 miles long, if you want to put it in rectangular terms. Across Highway 12 was Badger Village. If that had been completed and populated to design, it would have been a city of 5,000. Bigger than Sauk City and Prairie du Sac combined at that time.
So interesting. Well, the plant was operating during three wars, so it's had this long history, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. What was produced there?
Propellant. The stuff that makes the bullet go from the gun to the target. We made smokeless propellant. We're capable of making smokeless propellant for any weapon from the M1 carbine up to the 16-inch guns on the battleships. I don't think we did, but we had the capability. And then rocket propellant. During Korean operation, they built a ball powder propellant facility, and that was the only government-owned ball powder facility in the country. And that was the primary reason we got activated for Vietnam.
We're talking right now with archivist Verlin Miller about the history of Badger Army Ammunition Plant and the future of the land. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Has the plant played a role in your family's history? Have you ever wondered about it as you drove by? Did you maybe, or a family member, someone you know, work there? We'd love to hear your experience. And if you visited the Sauk Prairie Recreation Area that it's becoming where the plant stood, we'd love to hear your impressions. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation in just a few minutes and maybe hear what it's like to work in an area surrounded with nitroglycerin and other products like that.
And we're taking a look at the history of the Badger Army Ammunition Plant. At one point, it was the largest ammo plant in the world, but now the majority of it has been demolished and efforts are underway to restore the land to its natural prairie state. You can join with your questions and your comments, maybe your experiences on the land, past or present, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post at the Central Time Facebook page.
We have Verlin Miller, archivist with the Badger History Group, in the studio with us. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Mary on the line in Richland Center. Hi there, Mary.
Hi there. My father in 1942 worked at the plant. I grew up hearing about the plant. He lived at my aunt's house, my mom's sister, and my mom came down to visit her, and they ultimately got married. So I guess in a way I'd have to say that thanks to Badger, I'm here.
Wow.
But we grew up hearing about Badger, and I'm really excited that it's going to be turned into a park and in its natural state. And I just want to say I'm a sustainer, and to all the people out there, it's the way to go with public radio. Thank you.
Mary, thanks for the call and the kind words, and you can pledge at WPR.org if you want to follow Mary's advice. So Mary's dad, Verlin, was there right at the beginning. I mean, 12,000 jobs, as you said, this is right after the Depression. This is a big deal for the economy of an area.
Oh, yes. There was no I don't think there was any problem getting people to work at Badger in 42 because everybody was looking for a job. In 1944, they built the rocket production plant, and that was a different story. By 1942, everybody that wanted to work was working at least one job. A lot of people, I think, were working two. So they did a lot of recruiting to get people to work there to operate that rocket propellant plant. They had to work for it.
Such a fantastic call from Mary. And I know, Verlin, you've got a personal connection, too. Could you tell us a little more about what your personal connection was with the plant?
Well, I worked there for 26 years. One of the churches that was taken, my dad purchased for the lumber and tore down. After going through, looking at the history of the plant and the people that were there, I discovered that there are people that lost their farms there that were related to me, or I'm related to them. So, yeah, I have multiple connections to that place.
Does it feel kind of nostalgic to you now? I mean, it's got all this history of the land, but also the culture of the munitions plant.
I don't know if I'd say so much nostalgia it's been there all my life. And so it's changed, and I'm not sure I welcome some of the changes.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a little bit about working there. As I teased a little earlier, I mean, you worked with explosive materials. Did you have a sense of danger on the job?
Oh, sure. I worked in the instrument shop. So I could be sent to any place in the plant that had a process control instrumentation. I had electronics background, so I worked mostly on electronic instrumentation. That sent me into the ball powder area, rocket. No matter where I went, I was working with equipment that had explosives either in it or around it or whatever.
And you heard explosions?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. 3 weeks after I started to work there, I was working on the instruments in the oleum plant in the northeast corner of the plant with another guy who knew his way around the place, because I was new, and we heard a loud explosion. Everybody ran outside to a catwalk where we could see a little further, and those guys knew exactly where it was. It was ball powder, hardening house. One still out of eight in the building blew up.
Oh, boy.
And it made a mess of the building.
And there was something about the air there, wasn't there, that was particular to the ammunition plant?
Depending where you worked. In the smokeless process, the solvent was ethyl ether, or ether alcohol, I should say. In ball powder, the solvent was, for heaven's sakes, ethyl acetate, and also benzene in one part of the process. So depending where you worked, you had some fumes, but efforts were made to minimize the fumes, particularly with the ether alcohol solvent. They had a huge vacuum system that pulled the fumes out of the building. If they didn't, it would have been impossible to work in there.
And nitroglycerin fumes, was that an issue?
I forgot that. For people working in a rocket area, there are some parts of the process where the product had to be heated. And that gave off a lot of fumes, so people would have NG headaches, and NG is nitroglycerin. I had to go into one of those buildings one night when I was on shift, because a refrigeration man that I was paired with had to check some temperature control equipment in there. And I didn't get a headache, but I have a sinus problem, and as soon as I went into that building, my sinus was plugged up.
Oh, boy. Well, and now, you know, flash forward all these years, and the site has been rebranded. It is becoming a recreation area. A lot of the buildings already gone, and it's been open to the public for a few weeks now. What kind of reaction are we seeing?
I'm hearing good things. We have a museum right at the entrance to the plant. Right now it's closed. I'll get to that in a minute. But before we had to close, visitors to the museum was way up. And people came in. They wanted to see what it was. People had been driving by there for years and saw those buildings. And, well, what was this place? Now we can see it. Mm-hmm. And they go into the plant area, and there's nothing to see of what was there.
And the museum you mentioned, you've got some construction work going on. Do you have a sense of when you might be able to reopen?
Not really. Mm-hmm. The building just transferred to the DNR last month, which means that now the building has to be up to current codes for handicapped accessible, and it is not. When it was built, it met codes, but those codes have changed in the past 40 years. So we're closed now until we can make the changes necessary to meet code. And Badger History Group is the principal occupant of the building, so we're picking up the full tab of this work. So we need to raise $10,000 to $15,000. And that's going to make the difference of when we get it done.
Well, Verlin, good luck with that project, and I look forward to being able to visit the museum.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we've been talking to Verlin Miller, archivist with the Badger History Group. He joined us to talk about the history and, of course, the future still to come of the land that hosted the Badger Army Ammunition Plant.
Last weekend, the world learned about racist remarks that L.A. Clippers owner Donald Sterling made to his alleged mistress. Since then, the public and the NBA have condemned him for it.
On Tuesday, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver banned Sterling from the NBA for life and stated that he will move to force Sterling to sell the Clippers. The move was met with widespread approval.
While the public sentiment has been that Sterling's comments were way out of line, one difficult question that's come out of the scandal is, has Donald Sterling's right to privacy been breached?
Are we moving toward a post-privacy world? Well, here to help us address the question is Al Tompkins. He's senior faculty member for broadcast and online journalism at the Poynter Institute. Al, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Hi, Veronica. How are you?
Doing well. Well, there's general agreement that Donald Sterling's comments were vile on the subject of race. There's been no disagreement there. But there's also a sidebar here that's developing. And the question is that, you know, however odious whatever Sterling said was, the remarks seemed to be private and that maybe they should have stayed that way. How would you unpack that argument in this case?
Well, it's an interesting one because who among us hasn't had a conversation with someone we care about or know well, and you work through some difficult conversation. You might not even believe what you're saying when you say it, but it's worth having the conversation. And how would you have those kinds of conversations if you knew somebody was taping you and you knew that it might show up online? I mean, will we ever really have honest conversations about anything if we always know that there's a chance that somebody can shoot it up online? Isn't that the argument against Google Glass? Nobody wants to know that somebody is streaming the conversation all the time. You know, I think it's an interesting one. We still don't know all the circumstances under which this recording was made. Where exactly were they? It appears that it was at a duplex that some sort of condo that he had purchased. We don't know what the exact nature of their relationship is, although she says the words honey and love a few times. So there are many questions still about these recordings. And I even bristle some, like in the intro to this conversation, when we call them racist remarks, because racism does, in fact, sort of fall in the eye of the beholder. And we, I think that it's one of those kinds of conversations that people have to honestly have. I worry they won't if they think everything they say will end up on TV or the radio or online.
Well, as you said, there were some markers that this was a private conversation, the use of in terms of endearment, love and honey. On the other hand, you know, we do live in an era where there are gadgets everywhere. There's often some kind of device that could record a conversation or at least an image. Everyone has an iPhone. There are security cameras. You know, in the media and elsewhere, you're told to think that the mic is always on. So maybe people should be savvy. Maybe we are already living in a sort of a post-privacy
era.
In
the media, Veronica, you are. I mean, you know the microphone. You know the microphone is there. And as a matter of caution, that would be important. But let's say you two co-hosts are sitting in your office and you're having a discussion about whether or not you ought to go after a story or an interview. The real important part of that discussion is that you be able to trust each other enough to be honest about your concerns and to throw it around and kick on it some so you come up with a good decision. I mean, that's the way we do business. And that's not license for you to say something that's racist, but it is important that you say things that are honest between colleagues. But even more so, what if you were in your home? I mean, this was in a home. Let's say you're in your home. Don't you have an expectation of privacy? Well, legally you do, that's for sure. And then there's this other issue. California is a two-party state. That means that both parties have to know there's a tape recording going on. There's a significant amount of confusion about whether or not Sterling knew or should have known that there was a recording. There have been reports that have said that she, the person that often was referred to as the girlfriend, is in fact a stenographer, and that her job was to tape him and play back the tapes from time to time so that he can remember what he said. Well, I don't know if that's true. If it is true that he knew or should have known he was being taped, then it's a little easier to suggest that he should have been more circumspect about what he was saying. But still, there's this issue of privacy, and you don't have to like what he said to be able to defend the idea that there are places where you ought to be able to talk about things that don't become public without your permission. And I think that starts maybe at the threshold of your door.
Well, it's an interesting thing because he's not necessarily a public figure. He's not President Obama, but he is a person of influence in society. He has a fair amount of power, fair amount of money, and he's a person whose opinions matter to a certain extent. Does that make a difference here? The fact that we're not talking about, you know, your average Joe on the street. We're talking about someone who has cultural significance, and maybe there a different measure of privacy?
No question. Privacy is the civil right that works on a sliding scale, unlike no other. So the more public you are, the less legal protection you have under Times versus Sullivan. That's the Supreme Court decision. So it's harder to defame a public person under Times versus Sullivan. So there's no question that it's a sliding scale, and there's no question in my mind he's a public person. That said, does that mean that for a public person there is absolutely no privacy? If that's true, then we might as well just open the doors for every paparazzi to be able to shoot anything you want, walk into your house, tape you in the bathroom, whatever you want. You have no privacy? Is that what we're saying? The courts certainly have not said that, and I don't think that any righteous person would.
You know, this was brought up. It's funny how this story has unfolded, because the first reaction was, you know, general cultural upset about the remarks. And then you started hearing voices who are wondering about privacy. And one of those was a Fox News anchor who asked NBA Commissioner Adam Silver on Tuesday if it was okay for someone to lose their team for remarks that were intended to be private. And here we have an audio clip of that.
Jovian with Fox News, The Kelly File. Should someone lose their team for remarks shared in private? Is this a slippery slope?
Whether or not these remarks were initially shared in private, they are now public, and they represent his views.
So short and sweet response there from Adam Silver. What do you think about how he handled that question?
Well, he did a good job of handling the question and avoiding the issue. From their point of view, they can't unknow what they know, and that's interesting. Kareem Jabbar said something that I thought was particularly interesting, and that was, he said, why did it take this for people, for NBA owners and the league to get upset with Sterling? Was everything else he did not enough? And exactly the right point. This was a relatively minor thing compared to other accusations and lawsuits that he has come under. So what was it that happened here that tipped the scale? And
yeah,
I think Jabbar is exactly right about that.
Let's try to answer that question. So he has been under scrutiny before for discrimination about properties, about discriminating against minority group members, and yet it's his words, hearing him on tape, that inspired this visceral reaction. What is your answer to that question?
Well, I think it got a very heated. First of all, it was aimed toward beloved players. When you say something in Los Angeles that's derogatory about somebody like Magic Johnson, you're calling down the thunder in a very serious way. So, for starters, you're taking on an icon and basically trashing his name. That's never a good idea. On top of that, he also then has a target on him that's ready for people to pounce on. And then it gets amazing amounts of media coverage. the story is leaked. Of course, it's on TMZ first, and so people have to quote TMZ. They have no independent verification of their own. This story just is made for viral traffic. And then on top of that, we're in the playoffs. And then on top of that, we're in the May ratings book for television. I mean, it's almost a witch's brew of reasons why this story would take off, not the least of which is it's a really good thing to talk about, and that is race relations. That's one of the things that I'm disturbed about, Veronica, is that we haven't still talked a lot about what is it that he said that is so problematic. To listeners of your radio show, I have no doubt that the vast overwhelming majority would say, well, here's why. This is offensive, this is offensive. But we don't forward the understanding of race when we don't talk about it. And I think that conversation ought to go on as well. Exactly what did he say, and exactly why is that so offensive, is useful, if somewhat elementary. It's still worth having.
And it may still well go on. We're also looking at these issues of privacy in the meantime. Do you think now that we are living in a post-privacy era in our last 30 seconds here?
I don't believe that, by the way. I don't believe we're in a post-privacy era. State after state after state, for example, 4 hours ago, I was on a phone call with broadcasters in the state of Illinois who are concerned beyond concern that the state legislature is about to make 911 calls off limits to public record. In other words, you wouldn't be able to get a 911 call. And I suspect some of your listeners would agree with that. But there are movement in state after state after state, for example, to close 911 calls as a public record. People are trying to reclaim their privacy in very significant ways. At the same time that we seem to be losing it, this is a red hot issue because I think that there are a lot of people who are concerned that privacy is leaking away faster than they want it to.
And it's a national conversation that's going to keep on going. Al, thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime, you bet.
We've been speaking with Al Tompkins, Senior Faculty for Broadcast and Online Journalism at the Poynter Institute.